From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes with the Weekly Standard Magazine. Joining me on the show today are Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. And here are the issues. The Obama administration ordered 35 Russian intelligence agents out of the United States, plus other sanctions, in response to Russian hacking of U.S. websites. In response, Russian President Vladimir Putin said he would not expel any American officials. A ceasefire in the Syrian civil war was arranged by Russia and Turkey. The United States was not involved. At the United Nations, the U.S. abstained from a resolution condemning Israel's settlements. And Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe visited Pearl Harbor. This is a lot going on for the end of a year and a holiday season. Barbara, let's start with the action of President Obama, a pretty strong action. More symbolic than having a tangible effect, but very important.
I think it's more than symbolic. These are the strongest sanctions that we've seen against Russia in quite some time, and they were a long time coming. Obviously, the Obama administration wanted to make sure that it had done a really thorough investigation. And if you look at the information that was released along with the announcement of the sanctions, it's quite extensive. They have the internet addresses, the IP addresses of the various organizations that did the hacking of emails at the Democratic National Committee. They have quite detailed descriptions of the agencies that were involved, the GRU, which is the Military Intelligence Service, and the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB. Four top officers of the GRU were sanctioned, three companies and organizations that were involved in the hacking, and they also targeted two notorious cyber criminals that had been responsible for various crimes involving the international financial system. So I think what we saw was this big package of information that was put out there. Remember, Donald Trump said, where is the evidence, right? Well, here's the evidence. And then quite tough sanctions. They're kicking out 35 Russian diplomats, in quotes, and closing two facilities that had been used for recreational purposes by the Russians, and then sanctioning all these individuals who will not be able to travel to the United States, who will have trouble getting access to dollars. I mean, this is pretty heavy stuff.
Tom?
Well, I think so. I agree with Barbara. He could have done more, but President Obama, of course, said, this isn't all we're going to do. We're going to do a few other things. Some things we'll never talk about because they're highly classified, but basically, stay tuned. So we will see. I mean, I think this is basically sticking it to Vladimir Putin as President Obama heads out the door. I don't know what the political motivation here, if any, is, but clearly, I think Obama has now put President-elect Trump on the spot. And you know that because Trump has been skeptical of this. And as Barbara said, has said, well, show me the evidence. Well, even Trump is now saying, well, a few days from now, he will meet with U.S. intelligence agencies to hear the evidence. Now,
these are the people who've already declared that
that's
the
right.
Russians
and
have been
hacking.
And
he's already been briefed on this stuff. Let's be fair here. This is just a way of sort of backtracking kind of for show, I think. Don't you think, Tom?
Well, I think that's right. But I think it will make it difficult for Trump just to say, oh, well, let's bygones be bygones. He can say, as he has in recent days, let's move on to bigger and better things. But he can't be cavalier about what the Russians have done based on the evidence. So we will see what happens. So I think Trump will be under a little pressure. Whatever else Donald Trump is, he is supremely self-confident, and I think he sees he can figure out a way to get past this with the Russians, but it's going to be a little trickier for him to basically deny that they were doing serious and fundamentally bad things.
I think after meeting with all these intelligence officials, it'll put Donald Trump under a lot of pressure, actually. But I have two other questions. One is, Barbara, what took President Obama so long? I mean, he's known about this hacking for, it's been at least a year and a half.
Well,
what took him so long? I mean, I've heard his excuses before. I didn't find him compelling. And then he revealed a couple of weeks ago that he had actually brought this up in September at a meeting in China with Putin.
Look, there were a couple of waves of these particular attacks that were directed against the Democrats. The first was in 2015. The second was in spring of 2016. So in terms of amassing the information, I think that might have taken time. Also, you know, up until just a few months ago, and we're going to talk about this when we talk about Syria, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, was working with Sergei Lavrov to try to get a humanitarian ceasefire in Syria. And as Donald Trump will soon learn, everything is related. So you can't impose these kinds of sanctions on a country if you then want them to turn around and help you in another place. Also, as Obama has said repeatedly, he was trying not to put the finger on the scale too much before the election. He thought Hillary was going to win anyway, and that if he kept hammering on the Russians for this, this would be seen as some sort of colossal election interference, which is really quite ironic given the fact that it was the Russians that were interfering. But, I mean, those are his excuses. You can accept them or not.
Yeah, I don't. Tom?
I guess I don't think so either, although Barbara raises an important point. You can't just poke your finger in the eye of the Russians and then say, help us here, help us with the North Koreans, help us with the Chinese, help us with Iran, help us with the Syrians. It is a maddening and delicate diplomatic dance. And I think Donald Trump is not a guy who deals with a lot of subtleties or nuance. And I think he's probably in the process of getting quite a sobering education about how realpolitik works. And it'll be interesting to see how he tries to thread this needle.
My other question is about Putin. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a very clever response.
Oh, it's classic.
By Putin, which I think puts even more pressure on Donald Trump.
Yeah, it's classic. You know, Obama sort of is waiting till the last minute to kind of box Trump in on a number of issues, Russia, Israel, etc., to lay down his markers as he goes out the door. And meanwhile, Putin very cleverly is trying to make it easier for Trump to come in and lift sanctions over Ukraine. I mean, that's what's going on here. If he had responded in a tit-for-tat way and kicked out 35 American diplomats, that would have made it harder. He also knows that Congress is going to be doing its own independent investigation of the Russian hacking. Republican senators like Lindsey Graham and John McCain have been and Marco Rubio have been very, very outspoken on this. So Putin is giving them less ammunition now to go after him.
Senator McCain has referred to Vladimir Putin as a thug, a hoodlum, and a murderer. But one thing he's not.
And he was just getting warmed up.
Right. But one thing he's not is stupid.
Yeah.
He is not stupid at all. And I think as a political damage control device, this is pretty clever.
As they'd say in Russian, ochen umnyy chelovyek.
Okay. I think that we're done with that. What about the Syrian ceasefire, which, speaking of Putin, even he says it's fragile.
Yes, it's very fragile. This is something cooked up between the Russians, the Iranians, and the Turks. Supposedly, they've gotten 7 rebel groups to sign on, but it doesn't include, of course, ISIS. It doesn't include the al-Qaeda-related groups that are still fighting on. I mean, let's hope it lasts for a while. That would certainly facilitate humanitarian deliveries.
Pretty isolated what's left up in a corner of Syria now, though they don't have any cities. I mean, it looks to me like the war is just about over, and unfortunately, Assad has won.
The war is not over by any means. I think what we have seen, though, is that the Turks have done another 180. Really dizzying. I mean, watching Erdogan's foreign policy, it absolutely makes your head spin. Not so long ago, he was demanding that Assad step down and was part of this NATO coalition. Now he's completely, it seems, in bed with Putin, and they have made a deal, which is that Assad gets to stay and the Kurds in northern Turkey don't get to advance much farther. The Russians apparently have agreed to block their advance. Now, while this is going on, though, there is a Kurdish group still supported by the United States with something like 500 American special forces there, and they're slowly moving toward Raqqa, which is the ISIS capital. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a bifurcated picture. Aleppo now is relatively quiet, but that's because the Russians have bombed it into oblivion. Right. So it's a strange kind of ceasefire.
Tom?
Well, what it means, if nothing else, is that Assad survives. Propped up by the Russians and their air force, he stays for how long? You don't know, but his departure is definitely not imminent, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. It also is a reminder that the United States, at the moment at least, is not much of a player. And that obviously is part of the Russian calculation. They want to reestablish themselves as a major player in the Middle East. They want to diminish the U.S.'s impact and influence there. And for the moment, the Russians Russians are succeeding in that endeavor.
Tom, Barber mentioned the bombing by the Russians. Was the intervention, particularly their air force, they don't have a whole lot of ground troops there, was that critical?
Oh, absolutely. I think that tipped the balance in this war. It basically was the decisive element. The Russians have some ground forces, modest, and they have some naval units, but the whole-scale bombing by the Russian Air Force is what really changed the balance of power, especially the balance of military power on the ground. This is one of those cases where air power did make the difference.
I want to read one sentence. It's the last sentence in the Washington Post story of several days ago about this ceasefire. It says, "Peace efforts in Syria must still survive the many potential pitfalls of the shaky alliance between Russia and Turkey. But if Putin's gambit to play peacemaker among the bitter regional rivals of the Middle East is successful, it would mark his greatest international achievement to date, to broker a solution to the region's bloodiest conflict while excluding the United States would be an important shift in the international balance of power, one that Putin has called for publicly since he took power in 2000.
I would agree, but with the caveat that Syria is a failed state, a destroyed state, half its population has been displaced. The Russians can declare victory, but who's going to rebuild this place? For that, they're going to come to the Americans, I promise you. I think that's really premature to say the United States is out of this game. But if it makes Putin feel good, and if it brings some relief to the suffering of the Syrian people, that's all well and good.
Tom, what do you think?
All of this, I think, is a logical outgrowth of the celebrated instance a couple of years ago where President Obama declared a red line. Instead of Syrians use chemical weapons against their own people, he will act. Well, they did, and he didn't. And that has cost him, his administration, credibility within the diplomatic community. And I think when the history of the Obama administration is written, I do not believe that Syria will be a strong or positive talking point for the historians.
Yeah, let's also be honest here. I mean, Russia has committed war crimes. It's committed crimes against humanity. And at some point, somebody is going to have to be held accountable for that.
Well, it'll be Putin.
Putin and Assad and probably Iran.
Why did President Obama balk, do you think? You know, he'd laid down this red line and then he didn't follow through. I expected him to. John Kerry expected him to. He'd given a speech leading up to it.
Oh, there are a number of reasons. I think partly because the Russians cleverly came up with a plan to get rid of the weapons without military intervention. And also because Britain at the last minute, which was supposed to join the United States on the bombing mission, chickened out. You may remember that David Cameron asked for a vote in the House of Commons and it went against him. Mm-hmm. And that put him in an impossible situation and therefore Obama, who, let's face it, has never been a big fan of military intervention. So I think the Russians gave him a way out. He took it.
Is there any complicating problem in this for Trump?
Well, I mean, the fundamental problem that Trump will face here is trying to reestablish American credibility in the region. We are on the sidelines now, not forever, as Barbara says, but he has to reestablish American bona fides, and we'll get to Israel in a moment. This is tricky for him. He wants to make nice to Putin, but he knows he can't make too much nice, especially when prominent Republicans like McCain and Graham are out there pushing hard. And when the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says Russia is not our friend, so it's going to be tricky. One of a dozen very tricky situations that the new president will find himself in very shortly.
And well, we'll get to Israel in just a minute. But first, a reminder, you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes, of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues in the News online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/issues. Well, this resolution at the UN that the U.S. did not veto, will any good come of it, Barbara?
Oh, no. I think it's fair to say probably not. Again, it's Obama. He's kind of, you know, these are loose ends, right? at the end of his 8 years in office, and I think it was important to him. It was very important to John Kerry, in particular, to we'll talk about John Kerry's speech, but to lay down these markers. It's not the first time. Bill Clinton did something similar when he was leaving office in 2000. He put down what were known as the Clinton parameters for a settlement after the failed Camp David summit. So will it do good? No. I mean, Israel is, I think, moving inexorably toward a one-state solution. Anybody who's followed this issue for years and years sees that the chances of dividing up the West Bank in such a way that the Palestinians could have a viable state there are becoming almost impossible. There are too many Israeli settlements. And one of the most startling facts that came out is that there are now, you know, Israel has built what it calls the separation barrier. This is a kind of security wall that was built during the Second Intifada to prevent suicide bombers from coming in into Israel proper. There are now 90,000 Israeli settlers to the east of the separation barrier. So they are absolutely embedded into all of the area that would be part of a Palestinian state. And the Israelis are not going to move these people out.
Tom? Well, I agree with that. I also see no positive development here, and especially as long as Prime Minister Netanyahu is the leader of Israel. He has taken his government even further to the right than Netanyahu was when he was prime minister. Previously, he is beholden on the right's support, and he believes, I think he's right about this, that President Trump is going to be perhaps far more of a reliable ally than President Obama. Personalities always play a part in politics. Obama and Netanyahu never got along. They don't like each other. They don't trust each other, notwithstanding the fact that Israel is and the U.S. are signing off on a $38 billion arms package over 10 years that'll just make Israel the dominant military force in the region, more or less in perpetuity. But I think those who believe that settlements were an impediment to peace knew that if they didn't get a resolution put on the table at the U.N. this time, there's no way it would ever pass under a Trump administration. So this was their last chance. I can remember, Fred, so we all can, almost 40 years ago or 30 years ago when President George H.W. Bush was involved in all of this, and his Secretary of State, James Baker, famously went up to Capitol Hill and chastised the Israelis for building more settlements. And in, he famously said, here's the number of the White House switchboard. When you're serious about peace, give us a call. Yeah. And he's been ostracized by Netanyahu ever since. So this is not just an Obama fit of pique, although I think there's something to that. Democratic and Republican presidents for decades have thought that these settlements were an impediment to peace at best and illegal at worst. And so that part of this process is not new. What is new, of course, is the U.S. government casting an abstention on this resolution.
I mean, there's also a lot going on here, as you point out, Tom, between Obama and Netanyahu. I mean, I had to laugh. People were saying on Twitter, how dare Obama stick the knife in Netanyahu's back? Well, we all remember that Netanyahu was invited by the Republicans to come and address a joint session of Congress before the Iran nuclear deal went through. And he put a knife in Obama's back in the most extraordinary way. There is such bad blood between these two.
I didn't see much bleeding on Obama's part from that.
It'll be interesting to see. Now Trump is coming in. He's promised to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
That's going to happen?
He's going to be Bibi's best friend. And we'll see how well that works out. Bibi has a way of annoying almost every American president he's ever dealt with.
Well, some more than others.
Yeah, and Trump has thin skin, so this will be interesting to watch.
It will be. You know, one of the things I was struck by is, and how many Democrats, not just Republicans, objected to this non-veto of the resolution at the United Nations, but a lot of Democrats did too.
Chuck Schumer.
No, it wasn't just Chuck Schumer. It was Chris Coons of Delaware, who's on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He questions its timing and purpose. He said the resolution should have been vetoed. Aaron David Miller, remember him?
He was advised, I know him well.
He said this, which I agree with. It was a fitting end to an 8-year soap opera between Obama and Netanyahu. Yeah. He said, this is a migraine headache for just about everybody.
including Trump in a few weeks. I mean, it'll be interesting to see how Trump reacts when the Israelis establish yet another settlement and his Secretary of State, whoever that may be, says, Mr. President, we can't support this settlement, and you've been double-crossed by Netanyahu. So let's see how it happens. I mean, this is the big leagues. I mean, Trump, on many different levels, the president-elect, is in the process of learning that there's a big difference mm-hmm. between campaigning and governing.
Wouldn't it help if the Palestinians negotiated with the Israelis? Obviously, if there's an agreement...
what's left to negotiate? The Israelis are scooping up all the land. No, look, Palestinians have made many mistakes.
Obviously, if there's going to be an agreement, which one obviously does not seem to be in the offing, the Israelis will have to give up some of those, a good chunk of those settlements beyond the fence.
It's not going to happen. I mean, this is all really... you know, it's very nice, and John Kerry gave the most wonderful impassioned speech and all the rest. But the Israelis, not only do they have 90,000 people out to the east of the separation barrier, but they are also there. There's a law that's about to pass which will extend Israeli law to these so-called illegal outposts. I mean, they have annexed this territory in all but name. Tom is right, you know, to the right of Netanyahu are people who basically say annex it and be done with it. You know, the problem, of course, is that very soon there will be more Arabs than Jews within the area under Israeli control, and then they'll have to decide, do they want to be a democratic state? Do they want to be an apartheid state? And Kerry actually alluded to that when he talked about Palestinians being separate but not equal.
Israel is a democratic state.
It occupies land and gives minimal rights to millions of people.
When have the Palestinians had an election? They haven't had an election for a decade.
Yeah, and the last one Condi Rice proposed and Hamas won in Gaza. So anyway, that's
another
story. All right,
but we're not going to agree on that. Let's turn to Prime Minister Abe going to Pearl Harbor. Tom, what did you make of that?
Well, I thought it was a big deal. It was an extraordinary gesture. First of all,
and remember, I meant to precede it by saying President Obama had been to Hiroshima some months ago,
right?
This year.
That's right. But this is an example where President Obama has a very warm and close relationship with a world leader. He and Abe are on the same wavelength. I would put Abe up there with Chancellor Merkel of Germany and a couple of others as people who really click with President Obama. And I mean, I think it was an important gesture for all the obvious reasons. But notwithstanding the fact that Japanese politics are very, very tricky, it's hard for a Japanese prime minister to apologize, which Abe didn't do. He offered his sincere condolences to those who lost their lives on that day, which will live in infamy, as President Roosevelt described it. But so it was an important symbolic step. And I was just struck. I mean, all of us who have been there at the memorial to the Arizona, which still has his oil seeping up
from the
floor of the harbor every day. It's really profound. And then you look a couple hundred yards away, and there's the battleship Missouri, where the end of the war was signed on September the 2nd, 1945. Symbols mean a lot, and I think this was an important symbol.
Yeah, I don't know why. I don't think any of us was born by the time Pearl Harbor happened, but yet it's still such an emotional thing. For Americans.
And part of that reason is because we all remember where we were when President Kennedy was assassinated.
Yep.
We all remember where we were on 9/11, but it was our parents
who
remember where they were on December 7th, 1941.
Here's something that the Wall Street Journal said in an editorial, but very kind to Abe. It said, 75 years after Pearl Harbor, as North Korea's nuclear arsenal and China's revisionist ambitions threatened the Pacific, Japan is America's most important security partner.
Hmm.
Yeah, Barbara?
Yeah, I think it's a wonderful reminder of the fact that enemies can become friends. Germany and Japan are two of our most important allies now. And, You know, so I think we should keep that in mind when we demonize countries, we put them on axes of evil and whatnot, that it is possible that things do change. Of course, both of them became our best friends after we defeated them in a war. Yeah. So I'm not sure the parallel is that promising.
Well, it worked in those cases, for sure, Germany and Japan.
Yeah, of course, let's hope we never have a world war like that again.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Tom DeFrank, Contributing Editor to National Journal. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.